sins of communist Romania. The page, which contained a long list of crimes against the people, was in Romanian, so I pasted the web address into Google Translate. According to this, he was a member of the Securitate, the secret police. I read aloud, amending the slightly garbled translation as I went along. Like many of his comrades, Gabor was vicious and corrupt, using his high rank and the terror he induced in ordinary people to amass a personal fortune. Following the revolution, a number of women came forward to claim that Gabor had raped and abused them, that he ordered his underlings to use the fear of rape as a tool to intimidate whole families. "A real charmer," Edward deadpanned. I carried on reading aloud. After abortion was made illegal after 1966, many of the children fathered by Gabor and his squad of rapists were sent to the country's terrible orphanages, where they suffered appalling cruelty. There was a link to a page about Romanian orphanages during the communist era. I had read about these places before, just a paragraph in my Eastern Europe guidebook. I had tried to read the section aloud to Laura, the terrible facts about children tied to the bars of their cots, the systematic abuse and neglect. But after a few lines, she had tears rolling down her cheeks, and I had to stop reading. It was too awful to think about. But it echoed what we had seen in that house with a sickening twist. This time the mothers were chained up, emaciated, the babies relatively healthy and well looked after. The baby we had seen, anyway. We had no idea what had happened to the others, like the poor soul in that tiny coffin. After the revolution, Gabor disappeared. He is assumed to have been murdered by one of his former victims seeking revenge, but no body was ever found. I lifted my eyes from the screen. But he didn't die. He moved to that house and carried on raping women, getting them pregnant. Except he's not the man you saw there, is he? He's too old. According to the web page, Gabor would be 70 now. I shook my head. The man we saw must have been an accomplice. "Is there a photo of Gabor?" Edward asked. There was no photo on the page I'd been looking at, so I went back to Google and submitted the search again. There was nothing immediately obvious. "I'm going to head over to see Sophie, check how she is," Edward said. "I'll drop you at home on the way." "But I don't want to go home. I need to be out here, looking." He ignored me and started the engine. "There's nothing more we can do at the moment, Daniel. We need to leave it to the police." "No. I want to go to the hospital, to talk to Eon. I need to know more about this old man. He asked Eon if he remembered him. Maybe I can jog his memory with this information about Gabor. Maybe Eon knows where to find him." "But there's no way the police will let you see him. We don't even know if he's still alive." "I don't care. I'm still paying you, aren't I?" As we were arguing, I continued to flick through results pages on the search engine. Another result caught my eye. In pictures, the men of the Securitate. I clicked on the link and waited for the page to load, then scrolled down. There were numerous photos of men wearing secret police uniforms, frowning at the camera. Halfway down the page was a shot of Nicolae Gabor taken in the late 80s, shortly before the Velvet Revolution. It was quite handsome, with a strong jawline. He glared at the camera, clearly unhappy to have his photo taken. As he stared out of the photo, I stared back. It felt like he was looking right at me, into me. And as I stared at the photo, I recognized him. I'd seen him before. Chapter 56. We pulled into the hospital car park 20 minutes later. I asked Edward to let me lead, and he nodded his agreement. At the back of my mind, I knew I was heading for an adrenaline crash, that soon my body would notice that I hadn't eaten anything all day. But for now I was riding that chemical wave. I wasn't entirely sure how we were going to locate Eon, but as we entered the lobby I spotted the female police officer who'd been at the squat. I followed her at a discreet distance as she walked towards the lift, Edward a few steps behind me. The lift arrived, and as she got in I hurried closer, saw her press the button for the fourth floor. The stairwell was located beside the lifts, so I ran up the stairs to the fourth floor without waiting for the private investigator. I didn't feel at all out of breath when I reached the top, just in time to see the policewoman press another button just down the hall and wait to be buzzed in through a set of double doors. I followed, pressing the red button and waiting to be admitted. An Asian nurse let me through, but then stepped in front of me.
"Visiting hours finished an hour ago," she said.
"I'm police," I replied, using my authoritative voice. "There is no great trick to getting people to believe a lie. You simply have to sound convincing. In this case, it also helps if you act like you are going to be aggressive towards anyone who gets in your way. I'm here to see Eon..." I trailed off, realizing that I still didn't know his second name. "The stabbing victim. It's urgent."
"Oh, yes."
She hesitated. Shit. She was about to ask to see my badge. So much for fooling her with my authoritative air. But then another nurse appeared and called her. Used the word urgent, and the Asian nurse hurried after her. "Nurse, which bed?" I called.
40,
she replied as she vanished around the corner. Edward's face appeared at the door, and I buzzed him through. "Bed 40, I said. "If anyone asks, we're police."
"What?
Oh, I see." We walked through the ward, searching for bed 40. It wasn't hard to spot. The ward was divided into several distinct areas. Bed 40 was in the furthest of these, easily identifiable because of the policewoman sitting on a chair beside it, flicking through a magazine. Eon appeared to be asleep, or unconscious. He was hooked up to a drip, along with a machine that monitored his heartbeat. I guessed he'd lost a lot of blood.
"We need to distract her," I said.
Edward chewed his lip. "All right, wait here. You'll only have 5 minutes, okay?" I backed away, hiding behind a large laundry bin on wheels, aware of a couple of other patients watching me suspiciously, while Edward hurried up to the policewoman and began to wave his arms about. He gestured frantically for her to follow him. She hesitated, looked at Eon, then made her mind up, and followed Edward towards the exit of the ward. As soon as they'd gone past me, I approached the bed. I wanted to pull the curtain around for privacy, but feared this would attract attention. Plus, I wouldn't be able to see anyone coming. Eon's torso was wrapped in bandages, and his breathing was ragged, his face pale and sweaty. There was a vicious purple bruise around one eye, and more bandages on his head. Looking down at him, I experienced a surge of hatred. But I was glad he was still alive. There had been so much death, so much blood. Eon, by some miracle, had survived, and now he had a chance to make amends. I put my hand on his shoulder. It was cold and damp, and shook him. He stirred, wincing as he came out of sleep. But he didn't open his eyes. I tried again, and, leaning close to his ear, whispered his name. I was aware of time ticking away. Either the policewoman or a nurse or doctor could appear at any moment. "Eon," I whispered again, and he opened one eye. It took him a moment to focus. I guessed he would have been given heavy painkillers, but they couldn't completely eradicate the soreness from the beating he'd received.
"I'm lucky," he said.
I had to lean closer to hear him.
"I have a hard head."
He laughed, which brought on another coughing fit. He screwed up his face in agony.
"Oh, my ribs."
"I need you to concentrate," I said. "Laura and a baby, a completely innocent baby, are missing. I need you to answer some questions." He looked at me through half-closed eyes, a small smile on his lips. Perhaps the painkillers made him feel high. Or maybe he found this whole situation amusing. "The old man who attacked you, was this him?" I held up my phone to show him the photo of Nikolai Gabor. Eon nodded almost imperceptibly, so that confirmed it. Gabor was here. Everything was connected to what we'd seen in that house. "Was he part of your gang? Were you working for him?" He laughed, making a hissing noise, pain shooting across his face.
"The old man? I never saw him before."
"Don't lie, Eon." He frowned with confusion. "He was there, on the train. He was the old guy that Alina helped with his luggage."
"Helped with his..."
Realization dawned on Eon's face.
"Oh, my God. I didn't recognize him. I didn't remember."
I believed him. Unless Eon was lying about the old man asking if Eon remembered him, it had to be the truth. My mind raced, trying to make sense of it all. Gabor had been on the train. We had been kicked off close to his house. That couldn't be a coincidence. He must have arranged it in some way. I would work it out later. Right now, there were things I needed confirmed. What happened on the Trainion? You planted drugs in my and Laura's backpacks. Pain flickered across his face.
You found it? The cocaine?
I ignored this. And then you sent Camellia to try to find out what happened to the cocaine?
Yes. You know,
he coughed,
it would have been a lot easier if we'd done what Camellia wanted to do after we checked your bank account. There were no big deposits, so we were sure you either still had the coke or the cash from selling it. Camellia was all for us crashing into your place then and there, tie you up, stick a knife in your face, force you to tell us where the coke was, what you'd done with it.
He shook his head.
But I'm not a violent man, Daniel.
He tapped the side of his head and winced.
I use my wits, not my fists.
We never had the cocaineon. I didn't even know for certain that I was right until you just confirmed it. We left our backpacks in Romania, with the cocaine still inside, I assume, at the police station, with a cop called Constantine. Ian's eyes widened.
That bastard!
I heard a noise at the other end of the ward. A middle-aged man calling for a nurse. I didn't have long. I needed to get to the point.
Ian,
do you know where they are?
Who?
Laura and the baby and Alina. Confusion flickered on his face again. Did Gabor say anything about them?
No,
he coughed.
He was too busy beating me with an iron bar to stop for a chat.
He didn't say anything about taking Laura and Alina.
Why do you keep talking about Alina?
Because... What do you mean? Why do I keep asking?
I haven't seen Alina since that night.
He rolled his head and stared at me, his eyes opening a fraction more. My mouth gaped open.
You didn't know she was here?
If he hadn't seen her since the train, he wouldn't know what had happened to her. And right now I didn't have time to tell him.
What happened after you were thrown off the train?
He asked.
You came home, but where did Alina go?
I didn't reply. I was too busy thinking. I still didn't know who had taken Laura and Oscar. A sickening thought hit me. What if Alina had taken them? Alina seeking revenge because Laura and I had left her in that house. Or maybe Alina knew Gabor was after them and they were in hiding, but why take the baby? Edward and the policeman were still absent, but a nurse had come into view. She was standing with her back to me, but could turn round at any moment. If she saw me, she would throw me out. I have to go, I said. This visit had been a waste of time, even though Ian had confirmed my theory about the drugs. I still couldn't remember where I'd seen Gabor, and Ian was no help. There was a question that had been bugging me for ages. I decided to ask Ian before I went. Why did you and Camellia return my laptop? I asked.
Huh? We didn't. I bought myself a nice new one with your card. But Camellia had your old one.
So she returned it?
No, she sold it.
But it ended up back in my flat. It's the same computer. Ian gave me a blank look. Who did she sell it to? I asked quickly. The nurse had turned around and was walking towards us, a stern expression on her face. Ian thought about it for an agonizingly long moment. The nurse was almost at the bed.
Some old guy she met at the pole dancing club. She sold your PS4 and iPad to him, too. She was laughing about the idea of this old guy playing Call of Duty.
I interrupted him. The old man she sold my laptop to, was it Gabor?
I don't know. I never saw him, but he was Romanian, like us. That's all I know.
Excuse me, you're not allowed to be here. The nurse folded her arms across her chest, tapped her foot. One moment. I grabbed Ian's arm. His skin felt cool, clammy. The nurse moved towards me. Are you sure?
Yes. I remember now. She said she sold it to a man who had been harassing her at work. She said it was a weird coincidence. The day after we came to your flat, he asked her if she knew anyone with a laptop for sale, because he needed one.
No such thing as coincidences, I thought.
It must be Gabor.
He must have been watching her, saw her come out of my flat.
I really must ask you to leave, the nurse said. I'm about to call security.
I looked up at her, so stunned by what Ion had said about the laptop that I could hardly see her. But I became aware of another person walking towards us, the policewoman, and behind her, Edward, gesturing for me to come. I jumped up from the plastic chair, ducked past the nurse, swerved around the policewoman before she could challenge me, and grabbed Edward's arm, thumping the door release button with my palm and pulling him out into the corridor. We ran down the steps, our footsteps echoing dully behind us.
"What did you tell the policewoman?"
I asked. He waved a hand.
"Oh, but I'd just seen someone steal an old lady's bag. I led her on a wild goose chase through the hospital. I'm going to be in so much shit if they find out what we were up to. You know I rely on the police in my work."
"Do you want to know what Ion told me?" We reached the bottom of the stairs and headed through the lobby. "My laptop. Camellia didn't return it to my flat. She sold it to Gabor." He stopped walking.
"What? He must have returned it. How did he get a key to my flat? Jesus, it's like every fucking body had a key. Half of fucking Romania was waltzing in and out."
"Why would he return it?"
Edward asked as we exited the hospital.
"You checked it for spyware, didn't you, when it first reappeared?" "Yes, but..."
"Oh, shit."
"What?"
I broke into a run towards the car. Chapter 57 Laura stared out at the motorway. Since leaving London, they had driven in what was pretty much a straight line, through Essex. The devil sticking to the fast lane whenever he could, the speedometer nudging 100 miles per hour. Then they hit traffic, and the devil hissed and cursed, rhythmically rapping the steering wheel with his knuckles as the car crawled forward. Oscar, thank God, was asleep, his face against her chest, occasionally making a little snuffling noise that broke her heart. He had cried himself to sleep as they left London, the devil growing increasingly irritated. Laura had rocked and shushed the baby, telling the devil the baby needed milk, that he was hungry.
"There'll be milk when we get there," he said.
"He's breastfed," she dared to say. "He won't drink formula."
The devil snorted.
"He'll soon drink it if he's hungry."
He turned and looked through the gap in the seats, staring blatantly at her chest, making her skin creep.
"He wouldn't get much of a meal from those. Good hips, though. Healthy, physically at least. Your tits will grow when the time comes."
Alina sat in silence through all of this, staring straight ahead. Like she really was a ghost, an apparition. Laura could smell her, though. Stale sweat, the stink of fear coming from her pores. Not a ghost, real. And if Alina was real flesh and blood, it followed that the old man driving the car was not a supernatural being either. He was just a man. They were stuck in traffic for a long time, the old man's impatience growing every minute. At one point, Laura thought he was going to get out and punch the car in front. Finally, they started moving again. Laura counted the cat's eyes in the road to calm herself down. When she was a child, she would play a game where she would count white cars and red cars on family trips. Red cars outnumbered white, something bad would happen. She would fall ill. One of the girls who bullied her at school would be extra vicious. If white won, something good would occur. Her mum would leave her alone for a day. Beatrice would visit her. There was no point counting cars today. The worst had happened. She had resigned herself to it. Her only hope now was that she could protect Oscar. If she could somehow persuade this old man to return him to Erin and Rob, she would do whatever the devil asked. She would accept her punishment. They turned off the M11 and skirted past Bishop Stortford, heading further east. Laura saw a sign for Hatfield Forest, and soon they were turning onto a quieter road, then another, lined by jagged trees. The beam of the headlights illuminated them, as they reached out towards the car with bare, spindly branches. Beyond the headlight's beam lay the deepest, blackest night. They headed further into the forest. Laura clamped her eyes shut, held Oscar against her. She could hardly breathe. The car slowed, and she opened an eye, saw that they were approaching a large house half concealed by ancient trees. Oscar squealed, and she realized she had squeezed him. Beside her, Alina looked equally stricken, the ghost of a ghost. The car drew to a halt outside the house, and the devil killed the engine, leaving the headlights shining. Laura could hear Alina breathing. Strangely, witnessing the Romanian woman's fear made her feel braver, forced her to assume the role of the strong one. The car's lights revealed a period house with white-painted walls, a house that had stood here for such a long time that it felt like an organic part of the forest. It appeared to be in some disrepair, cracks in the window, the roof sagging in places. There were no other houses in sight.
"Just like home," the old man said.
He grinned at Laura, then turned his attention to Alina. Although his accent was thick, he spoke perfect English, like someone who had been studying it for a long time.
"You thought you'd escaped me, didn't you?"
Alina refused to look at him.
"Remember when I came to take little, what did you call him, Luca, away? We should have killed you then. Dragos was growing weak, as was his seed. Unless it's you who are barren."
His smile was cruel.
"We shall soon see. I'm going to do the job myself now."
He rubbed his groin.
"Still life in this old dog."
Laura thought she might vomit. She struggled to make sense of what the man was saying, but it was clear he was connected to the house, that terrible place. The man shifted his gaze to Oscar, forcing Laura to focus on the present moment.
"This one will fetch an excellent price. I already know a couple who will be interested, a Russian couple, old acquaintances who've moved to London, too old to have a baby themselves now."
Laura heard Alina whimper. Or had she made the noise herself? She wrapped her arms protectively around the baby. "What are you talking about?" It was cold in the car now the engine was off, and the man's breath plumed as he spoke. There was a gleam in his eyes that chilled Laura more than his words. He had the air of someone who believes himself to be invincible.
"Your friend here killed my son. A bastard, but still my son. She ruined everything. You know how long we lived in that house, happily running our business? 24 years, since I was forced to flee my job because of the fucking revolution."
Alina looked up at that point, her mouth slightly open, revealing the gap in her front teeth.
"Before that, it was a good time to be a policeman, a powerful position. So many women."
He said this wistfully, and went on, entranced by his own story.
"Most of the babies that I fathered went to the orphanages, but when Dragos's mother became pregnant, I was starting to think about my legacy. When the baby turned out to be a boy, I decided to keep him. The mother was a big mouth, never knowing when to shut this."
He pointed at his own lips.
"So, after she died, I bought the old house in Hunedoara and sent Dragos to live there with my mother, God rest her soul. She raised him, and then, years later, at the same time Dragos came of age, the revolution happened, and I disappeared."
His eyes shone in the darkness. Laura was reminded in a perverse way of her granddad, who never passed up the chance to reminisce.
"It was boring at first, so dull, after all the excitement of my job. But then one day, when Dragos was a teenager, something wonderful happened. Can you guess?"
He looked from Laura to Alina and back, then gave a disgusted grunt.
"No imagination. A pair of hikers appeared at our house. A young man and woman lost in the forest, like Ansel and Gretel. They came to the door, asking for directions. So I strangled him, and then Dragos and I had fun with the girl. It was about time Dragos lost his virginity."
He paused.
"I can't remember if we made Hansel watch while we screwed Gretel, but anyway, I decided to keep her. So we finally had something to entertain us. It was fun.
Laura swallowed hard. Oscar wriggled again on her lap.
And then,
he said, as if he was growing tired of the story,
Gretel became pregnant. Maybe my baby, maybe Dragos's. I was going to kill her, but then I had an idea. A stroke of genius. We were running out of money, and I was so bored, even with the nice young girl to fuck. I went back to some old contacts, people who had clung to their wealth. And the rest, as the saying goes, is history.
Alina spoke up, making Laura jump.
You're a monster, too, like your son.
He laughed.
She speaks. No, I am a businessman. There is a demand, so I supply it.
Laura reached out and took Alina's hand, squeezing it gently. After a moment's hesitation, Alina squeezed back.
You have spirit? I'll give you that,
he said to Alina.
I knew you would come here, to England, because you wanted revenge, didn't you?
He pointed at Laura.
She wanted revenge against you, for going without her, for leaving her to rot. Isn't that right, Alina?
The Romanian woman cast her eyes downwards. She didn't reply.
Constantine, that fuck, lied to me. You witnessed it, Alina. He blatantly lied, because he didn't want me to know about the drugs he'd found in your backpack, Laura. He paid the price for that. I buried him in the forest. The last thing he said, thinking the information would save him, was your and your boyfriend's names.
He reached out and stroked Oscar's downy hair.
This little one wasn't part of my plan. He's a bonus, another sign from God.
He stroked the baby's head again, and Laura fought the urge to snatch Oscar away, to cover him with her body.
I was excited to find the baby in your care, Laura. His parents asleep in their bed.
Laura hugged Oscar against her. She had been trying to work out why the old man had taken her back to Erin and Rob's after finding her in that squat. She had thought it must be because he was targeting the baby, but if he now spoke of Oscar as a bonus...
Why? She asked. Why take me back if you weren't planning to snatch Oscar?
The old man grinned and pointed a finger at Alina.
Because this naughty girl has been hiding from me. I've been waiting for her to show herself.
Laura understood. When she'd told Alina about the devil rescuing her from Eon and the other Romanian girl, Alina had finally come out from her hiding place, revealing herself to the man who was hunting her. She snapped out of her reverie as she heard the old man speak again.
Alina, you destroyed what I had in Romania, but it's fine.
He smiled like a wolf.
I can start again, here in England, and I already have my first little piglet to take to market.
Chapter 58. I asked Edward to make coffee while I booted up the laptop. While I waited, I grabbed a sheet of printer paper and attempted to draw a Venn diagram with stick figures representing the players in this drama. In one circle, the Romanian would-be drug dealers, Eon and Alina and Camelia. In another circle, Gabor and his unnamed accomplice, the man at the house. On the periphery, unwittingly drawn into the drama, Erin and Rob and Oscar. The policeman, Constantine, was there too, as was Edward. And in the centre, where all these circles intersected, were Laura and me. Camelia had sold the laptop to Gabor. It had to be him. There were no other old Romanian men in the picture. I knew how Eon's group had gained access to my flat. They had the set of keys they took from Laura's backpack. I didn't know how Gabor got a key. Maybe he'd picked the lock. For now, it didn't matter.
"What are you doing?" Edward asked, sitting down beside me. "Checking my spyware."
"But you already did that, didn't you?"
"I know, but only when the laptop was first returned. I didn't tell you about another weird thing that happened."
I told him about the photographs from the train that had vanished before my eyes.
"For God's sake, Daniel, why didn't you tell me about that before?" I was afraid that I'd imagined it, that I was losing my mind. If I wasn't crazy, there was only one possible explanation for the way the pictures had vanished. In the hospital car park, trying to work out Gabor's motive for returning the computer, I had remembered what had happened immediately before I saw the photos had vanished. I'd received the email with the kitten picture from Laura, except I was willing to bet that it hadn't really been from Laura. If I'd looked closer at the time, I would no doubt have seen that it had come from an email address set up in Laura's name. And the picture of the kittens had contained what I was now looking for. Gabor must have guessed I'd checked my laptop for viruses when it was mysteriously returned, so he'd delivered the virus later. I explained this to Edward as we waited for my virus-checking software to scan my machine. Then it stopped. An alert flashed up on the screen. I put my face in my hands.
Fuck.
What just happened? Edward asked. I tapped the laptop screen. There it is, spyware. I turned my head to look up at him. A piece of software on my laptop that gave someone else remote access to the computer. They could see everything I typed. They could add and delete files.
Can they see what you're doing now? Edward asked.
I returned to the keyboard. A minute later I said, okay, I've blocked the connection. But they'll be able to see that I've blocked it. If they're looking right now, they'll know I'm onto them.
And can you trace them? Find the other person's computer?
Let's see. While I worked, Edward called Rob and Erin's house and spoke to PC Davies, asking how the couple were doing. What did she say? I asked after he'd hung up, not looking up from the screen. I was getting close. Gabor's computer was still trying to connect to mine, and I was trying to find the IP address of that computer.
Erin's gone to sit in the nursery, staring at Oscar's cot. Rob's gone out to search. Apparently he couldn't bear to stay in the house doing nothing. The police have already gone door to door to talk to all the neighbors.
Did any of them see anything?
She wouldn't tell me much.
But Rob's got most of these neighbors out of their houses, and they're going round the adjoining streets. I continued to type into the command box, edging closer to finding that IP address.
Davies said that they've shown Laura's photo on the news. It's all over the web. People on Twitter are going crazy, calling her a baby snatcher, sharing her picture. The whole country is looking for her.
I winced. That's so wrong. She wouldn't have taken him.
I returned to the screen, tapping commands into the box, edging closer. Gabor appeared to be using some out-of-the-box hacking software, not particularly sophisticated. He'd probably bought it off some kid on the dark web.
Got it, I hissed.
It?
Edward asked, sitting up straight.
The IP address. Right.
I went onto the web and pasted the IP address, a string of numbers, into a specialist website. The result came back within seconds, giving me the region, along with the longitude and latitude. It doesn't give me the exact address, but... I opened Google Maps and brought up the area in which the IP address was located. My eyes met Edward's.
Back to the forest, I said, and a chill rippled across my skin.
Chapter 59. The old man led them up the crooked path. First Laura, holding onto Oscar, her arms wrapped around the baby to guard against the bitter cold, then Alina, trailing behind, her chin dipped. Laura's legs were stiff, and she felt like there was a swarm of flies buzzing inside her gut.
"Come on," the old man urged,
unlocking the front door and grabbing Laura's elbow, pulling her inside. He was strong, and Laura suppressed a shudder at the thought of his hands on her flesh. He grabbed Alina, too, and shoved her, sending her staggering ahead of them into the entrance hall. The air smelled of dust, and it was even colder, if that was possible, inside the house than out among the trees. Laura tried to catch Alina's eye, but the Romanian woman had withdrawn again. Laura knew how terrifying this must be for her. Laura could only imagine what was going to happen, what it would feel like. Alina had been here before, in another house, another forest. And Laura wasn't scared for herself. All she cared about was protecting Oscar. The baby was quiet and motionless in her arms, and she hugged him against her, worried that the cold was making him weak and listless. Cold and hunger. Could a baby his age go into shock? He needed his mum. He needed milk, warmth, familiar comforts. Her body pulsed with hatred for the man who had brought them here. Yes, just a man. And men could be hurt. The old man made a sweeping motion towards the stairs and swore at them when they held back.
"Do you want me to hurt the baby?"
he asked, reaching out. And Laura snatched Oscar away, which made the man laugh. Then his face grew stern and impatient.
"Get up there."
Laura went first, then Alina, the old man following. They went up one floor, and he flapped his arms, telling them to climb to the next. Just as in the other house, there was a closed door at the top of the stairs. The old man reached past them and turned the handle. The door swung inwards, and they stepped inside. Alina stiffened. Laura reached out to touch her arm. It was a replica of the room in Romania, but smaller, with fewer beds and cots. No Polaroids on the wall. Yet. The two beds had white sheets and blankets, metal frames. Two sets of cuffs were attached to the frames at each end of both beds. Laura could hear Alina's breathing grow heavier. She tried to stay calm, to take in the rest of the room. Next to the second bed was a white wooden cot. Piled up in the cot were several wool blankets, and Laura hurried over and snatched them up, wrapping them around Oscar. The old man watched her do this and blew on his hands.
"Good girl," he said.
She turned to him. "You can't believe you'll get away with this, do you? The police will find us." He smiled.
"You might want to feed him."
He nodded towards the far wall, where a table contained numerous items, the kind of things you would find in the home of anyone with a small baby. Plastic bottles, tubs of formula milk, nappies and wipes, barrier cream, and a packet of dummies. The windows were boarded up, planks of wood nailed across the panes.
"Can't have a repeat of what happened to Dragos, can we?"
the old man said to Alina. He nodded at Laura.
"Why don't you make the baby a drink?"
Laura hesitated, not sure what to do with Oscar.
"I'll take him," the man said.
Laura thrust Oscar at Alina. The Romanian woman blanched.
"Take him,"
Laura urged. And Alina acquiesced, holding him as if he was made of crystal, like he might shatter in her arms. There was cold water in a jug. Laura poured some into a bottle and added three flat scoops of formula powder. He had never had formula milk before. Would he take it, especially cold like this? Would it make him sick? She took him back from Alina, sat down, and gently pressed the teat against his lips. After a few moments, he took it and began to drink. Obviously starving. She felt him relax, and he looked up at her with his big blue eyes. The old man watched.
"I knew you'd be a good mother," he said. "The first time I saw you, I have a sixth sense for it now, after all these years. When you went into that sleeper carriage without the correct tickets."
Laura's eyes widened with surprise. He laughed.
"Yes. I heard you all chatting about it. I was watching you, thinking how wonderful it would be to have you at my house. The beautiful, valuable babies you'd have. I watched this little bitch's boyfriend sneak into your carriage and come back, the two of them whispering together."
Laura glanced over at Alina, who hung her head.
"And I was still watching as the train started to near my house, and the border guards appeared. That's when I realized I could make this happen."
Laura stared at the old man as Oscar continued to drink from the bottle.
"I had a nice little chat with the border guards, told them about the arrogant English couple traveling in the sleeper without a ticket, that I'd heard you boasting about it, saying there was no way these Romanian morons would throw you off the train in the middle of nowhere."
He was talking faster and faster now, his breathing growing heavier, excited by his own tale. He pointed at Alina.
"It worked out even better than I hoped. I wasn't expecting this one to get thrown off the train, too."
"You're going to die," Alina said.
He laughed.
"I'm starting to think I should only have brought the English woman. I only need her."
He reached inside his jacket and took out a knife.
"Get on the bed,"
he said to Alina. Laura watched as Alina obeyed, lying flat on her back upon the empty single bed, her arms crossed over her chest, no emotion on her face. The old man snapped a cuff over one ankle, then the other. He did the same to her wrists. He pressed the sharp edge of the blade against Alina's throat and put his face close to hers.
"You killed my son," he said.
"It felt great."
Alina continued speaking, switching to Romanian. Her voice was low, a sneer on her face as she spoke. The old man responded, also talking in his mother tongue. Although she couldn't understand the words, it was clear to Laura that Alina was taunting him, and that it was making him angry. His face grew pink as Alina spat harsh words at him, then laughed. Then she said something that made him stand straight and look at Laura, surprise in his eyes. He stared at her for a long moment as Oscar finished his bottle, and then he laughed again. He was about to speak to her when Oscar opened his eyes and began to cry, a sudden wailing that made the old man clasp his hands over his ears. On the bed, Alina laughed, and the old man pointed the knife first at her and then at Oscar.
"Shut him up," he said.
Laura tried to shush the baby, rocking him in her arms.
"He's still hungry," she said.
"I don't give a fuck. Shut him up now."
He approached Alina again, the knife outstretched. The baby continued to scream louder and louder, resistant to all attempts to quieten him. Alina's laughter grew increasingly hysterical, tears rolling from the corners of her eyes.
"Shut up," the old man yelled. "Shut the fuck up."
Something banged far below them. For a moment, Laura didn't think the old man had heard it, above the infant wailing and the laughter. But then he stopped moving, cocked his head.
"Do anything while I'm gone, and I kill this bitch and the baby," he said.
He left the room, and Laura heard the click of a key turning and a lock snapping into place. And as soon as he'd gone, Oscar fell silent, as if it was the evil old man's presence that had been making him scream. Alina stopped laughing and rolled her head towards Laura.
"Do exactly as I say," she said.
Chapter 60. We drove into the forest and stopped 100 meters from the house we were looking for. As Edward killed the engine, we were plunged into silence, as sudden as switching off a radio. I opened the door and got out, staggering like a newborn foal. The sight of the trees in the darkness made me cling to the car, my instinct screaming at me to get back in, get out of here, back to the city and lights and people. Here we are again. I felt like a man who is scared of heights, standing on a cliff edge. I could hear the trees murmuring, stretching out their bare branches and whispering my name. Somewhere in the dense foliage, something shifted and darted away.
"This time you won't get away."
"Are you all right?" Edward asked, joining me. I licked my dry lips.
"I thought I was going to be okay, but it's just like..."
I swallowed, though there was no spit in my mouth.
"It's just like last time."
"You want me to go alone?" he asked, placing a hand on my shoulder. "You can wait here."
"No, no, I have to do this. They're just trees. It's just a forest. And this place we're going, it's just a house."
"And the man we're looking for, he's just a monster." "We don't know for certain this is the right place," Edward said.
"It is. I can feel it."
He didn't respond to that. We had stopped briefly in the village on the edge of Hatfield Forest and gone into the pub, asked the barmaid if she knew of any houses in the forest that had been sold or rented recently. A large, secluded house, probably. I felt certain that Gabor would look for something familiar, and if he had been planning to take Laura and Oscar, he would need somewhere without close neighbours.
"The old witch's house," said a man at the bar with pockmarked skin.
I whirled to face him.
"What?"
I was thrown back to the night in the forest, standing at the door, a little boy's voice in my head telling me a witch lived here.
"It's not actually a witch's house," laughed the barmaid, who was in her mid-40s, with twinkling eyes. "People just call it that because the local kids all said the woman who lived there ate children. She died, oh, 5 years ago now."
"I heard someone had bought it," said the man with the acne scars.
They drew us a map showing us how to get there, not asking us why we were looking for it.
"'I still think we should have called the police,' Edward said now, looking along the dark path that led in the direction shown on the map. "'We should have left it to them. This fucker firebombed my office, almost killed Sophie and me.'
We had figured out that Gabor must have seen me submitting the online contact form to Edward and felt compelled to act. I guess that was his main reason for spying on me, to see if I had told anyone about what I'd seen in Romania. I tried to follow his reasoning. It would be much riskier for him if he killed me or Laura. There would be an investigation, a manhunt. It was much harder to get away with murdering a middle-class couple in the middle of London than in remote Romania. He must have been out of his criminal comfort zone, a spider straying from his web. So he decided to watch, to see if we did anything that necessitated the risk. "We've been over this," I said. I knew if we went back to the police, we would have to go through the whole story, the details of how we'd traced Gabor, in great detail. It would take time, time we didn't have, while Laura and Oscar were in danger. And there was another reason. I wanted to do this myself. I wanted this chance to make things right. We had a single torch between us, just as Laura and I had had when we walked through the forest looking for Alina. This path was wider, was in fact an unmade road, but everything else felt the same. I had come full circle, back to the beginning of a journey I hadn't wanted to go on. Tonight, one way or another, that journey would end. The torchlight traced patterns in the trees. I saw faces there, not animals or monsters or witches, but people. Women and children, their mouths twisted into screams, black eyes focused on me. I thought I could see dead babies hanging from the branches, imagine children peering from between the trees, whispering, "Go back! Go home!" I stopped, paralyzed by fear, my legs refusing to do what I told them. I heard another noise that sounded like a growl. It faded to a whisper, and that was worse. Edward put his hand on my shoulder. I cried out,
"Daniel, calm down. It's okay. We're fine. You can do this."
I nodded. I could. I could do this. We continued along the path. It curved to the right, and as we rounded the bend, Edward said,
"There it is."
The house loomed up out of the darkness, glowing faintly in the moonlight that bathed the clearing now we were free of the trees. Once again I was thrown back to the events of last year. The big difference was that this time I had come prepared. I had a kitchen knife in the inside pocket of my coat, which I hadn't told Edward about. Sure, he would try to stop me. I had my phone, too, fully charged, though when I looked at it, I saw that the signal here was extremely weak, just one half bar and no 3G. We walked between two crumbling brick walls into the courtyard of the house, where a black car was parked.
"Can you hear that?"
I asked. He nodded. From high above came the faint sound of a crying baby. I peered through the car's window and quickly called Edward over.
"That's Laura's," I whispered.
There was a hair scrunchie lying on the back seat. Laura's poppy scrunchie.
"Are you sure?"
"I'm certain. I was with her when she bought it. She wears it all the time." The baby stopped crying.
"I think we should call the police."
"No, we don't have time." He took a deep breath.
"Okay, right. We can't just go up and knock on the door. Let's go round the side, see if we can find a way in."
We crept along the edge of the house and found a pile of firewood logs stacked up on an apron of concrete along the wall. Above them was a small window with a rotten frame.
"Let me take a look," Edward said.
He climbed onto the woodpile and grabbed the windowsill, straining to peer through the window, to shine the torch into the dark interior. I put my hand on my chest. I couldn't believe my heart could beat so hard or so fast.
"I can't see any."
His words were cut off as the log on top of the pile wobbled, and suddenly the whole stack toppled from beneath him. I jumped out of the way, and Edward clung to the sill, his legs dangling 2 feet from the ground. The logs rolled to the concrete with a series of loud bangs. Edward held on for a few seconds, then dropped, falling onto his side before pushing himself up and inspecting his fingers. The torch rolled away towards the grass and blinked off, leaving us in the pale moonlight. Edward shook his head.
"I'm going to call the police. This is ridiculous."
He took out his phone and began to dial. Distracted by this,
I didn't see the man appear around the corner from the front of the house. By the time I noticed him and realized it was Gabor, he was raising the shotgun he held and pointing it at us.
"Edward!"
I shouted. He looked up from his phone just as Gabor fired his weapon. Edward twisted as he fell to the ground. He didn't make a sound. I froze for a second, watched Gabor point the shotgun towards me, and somehow managed to make my legs work. I dived to the right away from the house, the second blast of the shotgun reverberating in my ears. I lay in the mud, a few feet from where Edward lay. He wasn't moving. I saw Gabor walk toward us, reloading the shotgun as he came, a grim expression on his face. I scrambled to my feet and ran towards the back of the house, certain that I would at any second hear another blast, feel the lead in my back. I turned the corner of the house and saw a small coal shed on the edge of the lawn. I ran towards it and ducked behind it, crouching in the overgrown grass, peeking out towards the house as Gabor came around the corner looking left and right.
"I can see you," he said. "Come out. I won't kill you."
How fucking gullible did he think I was? I scrabbled in my pocket for my phone and, using my body to conceal the light from the screen, checked if I had any signal. Still half a bar. My hands were shaking so much I could hardly hit the numbers on the screen. 9-9.
"Drop the phone."
I looked up. Gabor stood over me, the shotgun barrel a few inches from my face. My thumb hovered over the final 9.
"Drop the phone now," he barked, jabbing the gun at me. "Now."
I did what he said. He stamped on it, shattering the already cracked screen.
"Stand up. Hands in the air."
Again, I did what he told me. The knife was in my inner pocket, but even if I was fast enough to grab it without getting shot, what could I do with it? My kitchen knife against his shotgun? I might as well have been carrying a teaspoon. He smiled now.
"I am actually glad you found me. You're the final loose end, the last one who knows anything about my son and our business."
I stared at him.
"Except you don't know all the details, do you?"
He shrugged.
"Sorry. You'll have to die without knowing the full story."
He pointed the shotgun at my face. I held up a hand, as if I could stop a shotgun blast. "Where's Laura? What have you done with her? And baby Oscar?" He grinned, if you could call it that. It was the grin of a crocodile looking at a wildebeest.
"Don't worry about them."
He steadied the shotgun again. I cringed, waited for the blast. But he hesitated, as if he were savoring the moment. Could I extend that moment, keep him talking, get to the knife in my pocket and surprise him? "Please," I said. "Just answer one question." He nodded, the shotgun barrel still trained on my face. I sucked in a breath. "The photos. Was that you? When did you take them?" My hand crept towards my pocket. Another nod.
"While Alina was having her passport checked, I snuck in, saw you were snoring like pigs, and took a couple of snaps with my phone. I sent them to my son, so he'd know who exactly he was looking for."
"But why show me those photos?" He shrugged with one shoulder.
"I was trying to flush out Alina. I thought you would tell your girlfriend about it, that the two of you would figure out that Alina was back, help lead me to her."
My fingers brushed the edge of my pocket. "Why did you delete the photos?"
"Because it amused me, Daniel."
I pulled out the knife and lunged at his leg. He dodged it easily, stepping aside and kicking at my hand and sending the knife skittering away. He laughed.
"It's a shame we can't talk for longer," he said. "I've seen and heard about some things I'd love to tell you about."
He pointed the barrel of the shotgun at my face. I closed my eyes. I was going to die. Worse, I had failed to save Laura and Oscar. I deserved this. Chapter 61. "Pull my boot off,"
Alina said as soon as they heard the old man's footsteps recede down the staircase.
The left one.
Laura laid the now sleeping Oscar gently in the cot and did as Alina asked. It slid off easily, and Laura was thrown back to a moment in the past, finding this very boot lying on the path among the trees.
Now pull out the inside part.
The insole? She nodded as well as she could. Laura hooked her fingers around the edges of the insole. It was still warm, and emitted a faint, unpleasant odour. It made a ripping noise as she pulled it out. Behind her, Oscar stirred in the cot, but remained asleep.
"Be careful," Alina said. "Under the insole should be a small piece of metal."
Laura tipped the boot up gently and felt something drop onto her palm, then bounce from her grasp and drop to the floor.
"Fuck! Please, Laura, you have to find it."
Laura dropped to her hands and knees, peering under the bed. She spotted the piece of metal straight away. Her heart thumped as she reached beneath the bed to retrieve it, gripping it firmly between forefinger and thumb.
"I got it."
Alina exhaled.
"What is it?"
Laura asked, standing up. The object was the shape and size of a small key, but without teeth, just an oval head and a long flat stem.
"It's called, I don't know the English word, a shaiba. You need to unlock my hands first. Hold the round part and slide it into the cuff where the teeth are."
Laura knelt on the edge of the bed and leaned over Alina. She took the cuff in her hand and inserted the shaiba into the space between the teeth and ratchet.
"Now, push down on the teeth, as if you were tightening the cuffs, and push the shaiba in at the same time."
Laura did this, and, to her amazement, heard a click.
"Now, undo it."
She pulled the cuff open, freeing Alina's left arm.
"You came prepared," Laura said, as she moved around the bed to work on the other handcuff. "It is the first thing I bought when I came here. I spent months chained to a bed. I was never going to risk that happening again." "I'm so sorry," Laura said, her voice cracking. We thought he shot you as soon as we left. We tried to report it, but I know. The old man, his name is Nikolai Gabor. I found his name on some papers in the house, along with the names of all his victims, all the women he and his son raped and murdered in that place. They are here now with us, urging me on."
Her eyes glinted. Laura looked at the air around Alina. She nodded.
"I can feel them. I have the names of all the babies, too, the families they sold them to. It's in my back pocket. Take it."
She lifted her bottom, and Laura plucked a crumpled sheet of paper from the back pocket of Alina's jeans.
"Look after it, Laura. It's the only chance those children have for justice. Promise me."
"I promise."
She hesitated.
"I'm so sorry that we left you there in that house. With him."
Alina shrugged.
"His son was worse."
Laura shook her head, continuing to work on the cuffs. This one was awkward, refusing to open.
"I'm glad I went to that house," Alina said.
Laura gaped at her.
"They'd have gone on doing it if I hadn't."
Laura saw it then. Yes, they had been meant to go to that house. She went back to work on the cuffs.
"When I think about how close we came to not going there,"
Alina shook her head.
"Gabor gave Dregos hell about almost screwing it up. I heard them. We made the first part of it easier for them. Dregos was meant to intercept us at the station, pretend to be a helpful stranger, or force us to go with him at gunpoint. I don't know, but he was slow. By the time he got going, we were already walking along the tracks towards him."
The second cuff clicked open, and Alina rubbed her wrists. Laura handed her the shaiba, so Alina could work on her ankle cuffs herself. While Alina worked, she said,
"If I hadn't gone into the woods, I guess he would have intercepted us on the tracks, at the closest point to the house. That's when it started to go wrong. He grabbed me, took me back. Gabor was furious that Dregos didn't just leave me there, tie me up, and go straight back to you. But he was overexcited, started tugging at my clothes, telling me all the things he was going to do to me. He was never that talkative again."
The third cuff clicked open, and she moved on to the final one.
"He was so busy taunting me that he didn't hear you and Daniel enter the house. You know what happened next, but he didn't tell his dad that you were ever there, that you escaped. Too ashamed,
Gabor believed that you must have thought I'd run off and that you didn't know the house existed. When Dregos eventually told him the truth, Gabor went crazy.